Srimad Bhagavatam Ki.
Jai.
Today we're reading 178, and this is the in the first few chapters we meet the sages of Naimisharanya, headed by Shonaka Rishi, who is not only blessed with many years and a leader of the house, but also a very profoundly erudite scholar. And they confess to Suta Goswami that their sacrifice at Naimisharanya for the welfare of the universe is not producing much good result. So they ask him, what is the proper scripture for the age of Kali? So many scriptures. What's the essence of all the scriptures? What is the best dharma? What else we got? What are the different incarnations, their significance, and especially what is the significance of the incarnation of Vasudev and Sankarshan, Krishna and Balaram? And so he answers those questions very nicely, and of course, then he says, Srimad Bhagavatam is the best scripture, it's the proper dharma for this age, hearing and chanting Srimad Bhagavatam. Now that Krishna and Balaram have left, we'll find this shelter here. So we've already studied this in chapters 1, 2, 3. And then there's a whole story. He says, okay, so I'll try and explain to you Srimad Bhagavatam as I heard it. Yataditam yatamati. I got the message from Sukadeva Goswami. I was listening when he was preaching to Maharaj Pariksit, so I also understood it. He wasn't a direct student. He was just in the class. But he got it. So he became qualified to be an acharya, even though he wasn't a direct student. And so he says, yataditam yatamati. I shall now try to make you experience it as I experienced it. So that means that sometimes the teacher will look at the audience, he'll add some things, he'll take some things out. So Srimad Bhagavatam is not like a passing knowledge. Srimad Bhagavatam is communication of a perspective, getting people to realize the perspective, the idea like that. So then he starts telling the history, how Maharaj Pariksit first saw Krishna in the womb, he's going to be the audience, how the Pandavas left, creating this vacuum. So he starts off with that in chapter 5, but then he kind of steps back a little bit and gives a broader perspective, maybe seeing his audience. He sees that he has to give a little more broader perspective. So he discusses how Krishna is leaving for Hastinapur, how Kunti tries to get him to stay, and then he does stay, and then the disappearance of Bhishma Dev, which also happens, and Maharaj Pariksit organizing all these sacrifices like that. So actually, before that he describes it, the 4, 5, 6 is the meeting of Narada and Vyas, like that. And then he's describing how Vyasadeva started to compile the Bhagavatam after Narada Muni gave him the impetus. And that's what we're talking about now, is he starts thinking about all these different perspectives and stuff like that, and the value of the Bhagavatam. He's been told to do it, so before starting his Sankirtan, he's thinking about getting it fixed in his mind, why it's valuable, all these things. And the sages are making those comments like that. So the verses right before this, of course, is describing that Srimad Bhagavatam is really for the Paramahamsas. It's for people who have realized Brahman, they've realized Paramatma, and now by the Bhagavatam they can go ahead and realize not only Bhagavan, but they can realize Bhagavan in his most intimate aspect. So it's like, it's for Paramahamsas. But in the previous verses it says that even ordinary people, just by hearing these pastimes, they'll be able to pass through the preliminary stages of becoming extremely pious, punyatma, and get free from all their simple activities. Tesham jananam punya karmanam tesham tvam tvagata papam jananam punya karmanam. So Bhagavatam will do that. And even though they're not ready for the Paramahamsa benefit, just by hearing it they'll become pious people. Then they can start to take to the higher levels and become fixed in transcendental knowledge, jnana, and then like that. And so then today he's talking about a little bit more of the history of the Bhagavad Gita. The great sage Vyasadeva, after compiling the Srimad Bhagavatam and revising it, taught it to his own son, Sri Sukadeva Goswami, who was already engaged in self-realization. And this is the Anukramya. And so it's very, very close translation with the text there. Then the purport, which is on the screen there, try something here, oh my God. Okay, anyway, I've lost it. Okay. Srimad Bhagavatam is a natural commentation on the Brahma Sutras, compiled by the same author. This Brahma Sutra, or Vedanta Sutra, is meant for those who are already engaged in self-realization. Yeah. Srimad Bhagavatam is so made that one becomes at once engaged in the path of self-realization simply by hearing the topics. Although it is especially meant for the Paramahamsas, or those who are totally engaged in self-realization, it works into the depths of the hearts of those who are worldly men. Yeah. Worldly men are all engaged in sense gratification. But even such men will find in this Vedic literature a remedial measure for their material diseases. Sukadeva Goswami was a liberated soul from the very beginning of his birth, and his father taught him Srimad Bhagavatam. Amongst the mundane scholars, there is some diversity of opinion. Okay, so here's pretty much there's another topic being taken up. But if we go back to the first part, can you go back, Ramananda? Back to the first part of the purport. Go back up, yeah. Now, up to the first part. Okay. So, this is the point we made before, is that Srimad Bhagavatam is so nice that it, again, it's for the Paramahamsas. So, in the second chapter, which we've already studied, is discussing, you know, Vedanti tattva vidas tattvam yaj jnanam advayam brahmati paramatmati bhagavaniti sabdate. That the great transcendentalists, they realize the absolute truth in these three features, Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. Buddha came along, at least the followers of Buddha say this, and said there is no reality. You know, you think that your nation is a reality, and you should die for your nation, you should sacrifice for your nation. You know, my Nigeria, my Germany, my America, you know. But I said, no, it'll come and it'll go. All these empires are coming and they're going. The great empire of the Hittites, which existed like 2000 BC or something, and they were fighting the Macedonians over Troy. So actually, yeah, archaeologically, the evidence is there was a Troy, and there were Macedonians, and they came to attack the city of Troy, and not because of Helen, because she was so beautiful, but for something else. And then the Hittites with their armies were defending it. But now it's just a gigantic effort to see if they even existed, you know, archaeologically. So all these nations are ephemeral. So we agree with Buddha, you know. So the nation is ephemeral, your family is ephemeral, your body is ephemeral, even your mind, all these things, you know, are just, you know, are not true. And of course, the Buddhists also say, some Buddhists say, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, because Buddha is also illusion. So it's an incomprehensible philosophy. I was trying so hard to understand Buddhism when I was becoming a devotee, and then I read Prabhupada says it is an incomprehensible philosophy, and oh, it was such a relief, because I realized you can't understand Buddhism. You know, those who know do not speak, those who speak do not know. Okay, so many things, you know, nonsense, you know. So Buddha was really, you know, not even concerned about these things. He didn't say there is no self. He didn't say there is no God. He said you're not ready for these topics. first thing you've got to figure out is try to be a good man or a good woman and take spiritual life seriously. And so that's all Buddha basically preached, Upadharma. But his followers come up with this nihilism. So then along came Ramanujacharya and said, Shankara, there is a reality like that. You know, Sat, Brahman, there is a reality. What is it? Don't worry about that. Right now, you know, you give up this paranoia that Buddha created. There is a reality. Oh, wow, what a relief. So he talked about many things, of course, but his main mission, he established, you know, Brahman. Then after that came Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya. What is it? Vasishtadvaita, Shuddhadvaita, Dvaitadvaita. And they established that this reality has variety, that you and I are different forever, that we and God are different forever, and that we and matter are different forever. So we start to come to chit. Now, there is a reality, and we can know it. You know, this is cognizable, like that. You know? And then finally, Ananda, that we can engage in a relationship with, you know, we can engage in an eternal relationship with what we know. A nice example, I remember Prabhupada says, it's like you go into the kitchen and there's farina, suji, two pots, stove, a spoon, butter, and sugar, you know. So what do you have? Halava, if you know what to do with it. So sat, you're in the kitchen, chit, you know what's going on, and Ananda, you know how to deal with it. Oh, Ananda is Ishvara Parama Krishna Satya Ananda Vigraha. You know, Krishnira Swarupoi Nityara Krishna Das. That's Ananda. You know, I know when my service to Krishna, and I can always be improving it, improving it, improving it, like nobody else. You know, I can do my service and improve it forever. And Krishna will get real satisfaction from this, my friend. You know, so that's the Ananda. You know. So different people are on different levels. And Vedanti Tat Tat Bhavidas. Yeah. And so the Bhagavatam is then for people who know Brahman, Sat, they know the Paramatma, Chit, and now they're engaging in Ananda. So in the beginning, it's starting off talking about it, Hokshaja, and all these kind of things like that, in the first chapters of the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says Krishna, but many times he's translating like it, Hokshaja, or something like that. So it starts off like that, with this, you know, gradually building up. But definitely from the very beginning, it said this is for the paramo nirmatsaranam satam. This is for the devotees who are free from all envy and everything else. You know? And it's a commentary then on Vedanta Sutra, which is also for the people who are already gone through all this. Brahmasam, how does Vedanta Sutra start? You and all know, right? Atato Brahma Jijnasa. Atato, now, Brahma, the absolute truth, Jijnasa. Because when Vyasadeva was compiling these things, actually his name was Dvaipanyaya Muni. So when Dvaipanyaya Muni was doing his work, there were many other, you know, sages and philosophers there, great grand scholars, scientists, sages. And Veda was there, Veda Shruti was coming down, and it was one. And from these, there are different kinds of extracts and branches and comprehensions and everything else like that. You know? So Dvaipanyaya was one of the people who was dealing with all this. And of course, he divided it. So he's called Veda Vyas. He divided the Veda. Veda Vyas, Dvaipanyaya Muni. But other people, they look at him as one Muni, you know, one philosopher, one person with his perspective like that. You know? So, you may know that when he divided everything, there are the four original Samhitas, Rig, Yaja, Atharva, and Samaveda. So they're composed of Samhitas, which a lot of them are actually just rituals for defeating your enemies, for getting a good marriage, for having good education, for taking good health. So a lot of them are just like this karma kanda, for living in this world quite successfully, for counteracting your sins to get out of hell, you know. And so then to do this, with every Veda there's associated a set of brahmanas. And the brahmanas are the instructions of the brahmins, the grihasthas can do these sacrifices. Then also associated with each Veda there are a set of aranyakas. And aranyakas, aranya means forest, are for the vanaprasthas. You know, so they can do their work. Then finally with each Veda associated are a set of Upanishads. And the Upanishads then are for the sannyasis, the complete nyasis, sankirtan, sannyas. So they've given up everything. So that's the point, is that we've given up everything, all these ritualistic activities, and now, atato, brahma-jignasa. Now it's time to try and understand the absolute truth, that which expands everywhere, which is never wrong, always true. Yeah. But the Vedanta Sutras are so concentrated. You know, if you even just see a translation with no commentary, it has parentheses, 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 because otherwise it's completely, for us, you know, but probably for many people, completely incomprehensible. Like it starts out as, thus as, therefore as much. Okay, next sutra. Thus as, therefore as much, you know. And then, therefore as much, then, therefore, we, you know, it is so, you know. So the parentheses will say thus, you know, having covered all the karmakanda in parentheses. So they're very, very concentrated. Most likely there was never even an expectation on the part of Vyasadeva that, you know, people would try to understand them without a teacher. And possibly that's even why they are so incomprehensible. So they're inaccessible to just anybody getting hold of them and taking advantage of them and creating a bogus philosophy. You know, you can only understand them if they're explained like that. Yeah. So therefore there's so many commentaries, Parijata Bhasya by Nimbarka Swami, Sairakya Bhasya by Shankara, the Govinda Bhasya by Baladeva Dibhusan, like that. Yeah. Because otherwise it's just, you know, it's incomprehensible. You know. But everything is there. Again, the same thing. It starts off the same place the Bhagavatam starts off. Atato Brahma Jignasa. You know, this is for people who have given up everything else and are just dedicated to understanding, you know, what is the absolute truth and to getting free from all the miseries created by time, you know, creation, maintenance, and destruction, like that. So Bhagavatam is a natural commentation on Vedanta Sutras compiled by the same author. Brahma Sutra or Vedanta Sutra is meant for those who are already engaged in self-realization. Because most people are not engaged in self-realization. They're engaged in realizing the gratification of their tongue and belly and genitals. Yeah, yeah. Prabhupada says that most people are engaged in the touch of the skin. You know, contacting the skin with the objects of the sense gratification. So, of course, maybe that means the fingers, but also the tongue is also made of skin, right? So all we're doing is sticking the tongue, which has some liquid on it, to create intimate bonding with the objects of sense gratification. And the same with the nose is also a kind of skin. But beyond that, there's also the body made of prana. And so when we eat something, it has like a nice, you know, agitation for our feeling. You know, it agitates the tongue, the throat, very palatable. If you take sugar and see what it does, it actually burns. If you give a little child sugar who's never had it, he'll spit it out because it's just, it burns so much, you know. It's like drinking whiskey or something, you know. So what you notice, it actually burns your throat, you know, it goes down, it burns the stomach. So sugar has this very strong agitation of the prana, the tactile body, and we do it in such a way that, you know, gives us the kind of gratification we want. You know. So most people are engaged in that level. You know, it's describing this, you know. You know. But even though Srimad Bhagavatam is for Paramahamsas, is the point we made before, it has this facility that even ordinary people can just read the stories. And if the stories are presented like with real comprehension, they become very, what's the word, they grab your attention, the pregnancy of Ditti in the evening. You know, we tell these things in modern ISKCON perspective, and people are just like, you know, attracted. I stopped doing it because some of them, people say, oh, Hanumapriya Swami said there was one girl set herself on fire. in the temple in Italy. Oh, did you hear what happened? Mara said, I say three times after it, you know, this was just a story of Sati and Daksha, you know, put into modern language. It didn't happen, you know. But then people don't catch up on that, and I get, you know, chastised by the GBC for creating all these bad rumors about ISKCON. But you see, everything is happening in ISKCON amongst the gods and goddesses of ISKCON, you know, the demigods and the rishis and everybody else, are things that are in the Bhagavatam. Hansaduta told us that Prabhupada told them that every single psychological circumstance you can encounter, you'll find in Srimad Bhagavatam. So yeah, the basic things are there, but as we go ahead, we start getting more and more advanced problems. You know, we think, oh, I'm following the four principles, I'm chanting 16 rounds. Yeah, yeah, but then you're going to discover other problems, you know. Pregnancy of Ditti in the evening. She wasn't a lusty girl who just wanted to have, you know, some gross gratification with her husband. She had a rightful complaint that all of her sisters and everything had kids, and they're all like maybe even teasing her a little bit. You know, doesn't your husband love you? You know, so she had a legitimate complaint in many ways, you know. And so that was what she wanted. She wanted to be able to show her baby off in terms of her friends and everything else, you know. So it's quite understandable. But there were some problems, and they created problems. So we go through the Bhagavatam, taking it to heart, taking the stories to heart. Then whoever we meet, wherever we go, we can penetrate right into them and give them an incredible, you know, perspective on the absolute truth. So Vedanta Sutra, I was saying in the beginning, you know, Bhagavatam is the commentary. It's four Paramahamsas, but also the stories are engaged in such a way that if a person presents them properly, self-realized, and the stories will just attract an audience like that. So we have so much work to do to put these stories like into, you know, multimedia, PowerPoint, everything else, you know, so on. You know, so that's kind of the first point. And Sukadeva Goswami, he's liberated. Actually, two verses ahead, of course, is the Atmarama verse. Atmarama. Why does Sukadeva Goswami study this? He was liberated. So the famous Atmarama verse is that even Atmaramas are attractive. Yeah. And you can see Prakashananda Saraswati, I think him, but definitely Sanatana Goswami and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that was how they tested Lord Chaitanya. They wanted to see his commentary on the Atmarama verse. I've read atheists who believe that everything was created by evolution, Indian scholars, say that the highest manifestation of evolution is Srimad Bhagavatam. Isn't evolution wonderful? It's produced human beings, it's produced culture, it's produced Indian philosophy, and it's produced the Srimad Bhagavatam. Like that. So even atheists appreciate the Srimad Bhagavatam. Or to speak of Brahmavadi as everybody else. It's self-evident. Some people hate Krishna, some people love Krishna, some people, you know, but you can't avoid Krishna. So the more, and Radhika Raman and Krishna Kshetra have just published a book that came out finally after all this work, Contemporary Thinking on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So I think probably you look up in Amazon.com for Ravi Gupta, you can find it there. And I think it's by Cornell or Columbia Press. So it's a very significant work, Contemporary Thinking. It's going to have a big splash. Because nobody knew about Srimad Bhagavatam. It's just covered. There's just no translations, no contact. So Prabhupada made it available to sincere people, and those sincere people are making it known in all these different areas like that. Yeah. So go on down then, amongst mundane scholars. Okay. Amongst mundane scholars, there is some diversity of opinion as to the date of compilation of Srimad Bhagavatam. So I think, you know, this is if you actually get into this stuff, researching, I think Srila Prabhupada here is being, you know, rather sarcastic like that. Yeah, he knows. Amongst mundane scholars, there is some diversity of opinion as to the date of Srimad Bhagavatam. Mundane scholars. Now this, of course, is a big area if you're trying to preach to these people. And it's important preaching to them. It's like Lord Chaitanya, he was preaching to Sarvabhauma, He was preaching to Prakashananda Saraswati, because ultimately these are the people that teach the teachers. And it comes down like that, and if they think their teachers know everything, then they say, oh yeah, there was no philosophy until the Greeks, the Indians have the oldest myths. You know, there's so many misconceptions which will keep people from understanding the Bhagavatam and its worth like that. And many times they're mundane just because they haven't had any contact in the right way. And if somebody hasn't explained it to them in the proper fashion like that. So we met one scholar, he read the Mahabharata, a very nice person. He read the Mahabharata in Sanskrit like 7 times. What does that take? To read the entire Mahabharata in Sanskrit. I think he said, I guess he'd done it. That's 700,000 verses. You know? Yeah. And we started talking about things, and he had a little different opinion. But I presented things a little bit logically, and he said, yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought about it that way. Okay, yeah. You know? So many times, everybody has their own area of preaching and everything else, you know, and everybody's equal, doesn't matter. But his preaching, that the way Lord Chaitanya was doing it, was different than Lord Nityananda. And so he was preaching to Prakashananda Saraswati, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Ramananda Roy, you know, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, you know. And so these mundane scholars, they have their diversity of opinion, and I can maybe present a little bit about that. There's a very, very nice paper by Advaita, and I think he's from, maybe you know, what was his name? Oh, I forgot his name now, his karmic name. Edwin Bryant. And Satyaraj published it in his journal. And I think you can download it if you go to the Journal of Vaishnava Studies by Satyaraj. I think it's available there. But he goes through a whole thing on the history, called the date and provenance of the Srimad Bhagavatam. How old is it, everything else. So the general opinion was, one opinion was, that it was composed by some monk named Bhopadev, in the 12th century. That's when the Bhagavatam was produced. It was produced in the 12th century by some monk named Bhopadev. And Prabhupada mentions that in the course in a purport earlier. You know? And then after that, Sridhar Swami, the first commentary we have, or anybody has, you know, like that, Lord Chaitanya is quoting it, occurs something like in the 13th century or something. And then Lord Chaitanya occurs, you know, after that. You know, so it was one kind of general dating. But their methods and everything else, they're based upon inscriptions, they're based upon carbon dating, you know, they're based upon so much speculation and everything else. But they do find very interesting things, inscriptions and so on. And they do give nice perspective on many things. Yeah. So Advaita, he goes to discussing all these things very scholarly, from the different scholarly opinions, and, you know, taking evidence which, you know, supports different ideas. So he points out, and Radhika was saying this because everybody was saying that Bhopadev compiled the Bhagavatam. He also composed some other great works. He was a genius, you know. But Radhika was saying he couldn't see where you know, where this was coming from. So finally, in his paper, Advaita points out that some scholar who was studying Bhopadev and everybody else, not in his book, but in an end note afterwards, he said, it seems to me that Bhopadev may also have composed, you know, the Bhagavatam, like that. It's, you know, maybe. It might have also composed the Bhagavatam. Then people quote from this person saying, oh, so-and-so says that Bhopadev composed the Bhagavatam. But it's very doubtful because in his other works he's quoting it as an authority. So you're not going to quote your own composition as an authority, you know. And there's no other evidence. So that particular, evidence that Bhopadev composed it is based upon, if you research it completely, unsubstantiated evidence. So anyway, then the other thing recently discovered, there's a temple in South India called the Vaikuntha Perumal Temple, and it goes back something to the 8th century. You can do this by cross-referencing kings and everything else, so on. So in that temple, there is a lot of inscriptions, you know, with pictures and inscriptions, and they include all the pastimes of the Bhagavatam. And so they say, well, that's okay. We know the Bhagavatam is an anthology. It's a collection of many previous pastimes. You know? The story of Vritasura in the Bhagavatam is also in the Rig Veda, which they consider to be one of the oldest. So they'll say, well, okay, it's no surprise finding these pastimes in the 8th century. But then the next thing is you point out that the order of the pastimes, the way the inscriptions and the tabloids go, is exactly in the order in which they're presented in the Bhagavatam, like that. And so then, oops, because, you know, so then again, there's very strong indication that the stories in the Bhagavatam, that the Bhagavatam was already there and well-known and respected enough and well-known enough to actually be inscribed, you know, in a temple in stone and stuff like that, which means probably it was even earlier, you know. So now suddenly from being composed in the 12th century, we've got to go just drop 600 years and go back. There are other things too. And the Sanskrit we're using is Puranic. The Vedas have a different Sanskrit. So the Bhagavatam has many sections which are composed of Vedic Sanskrit. And I think it's the things that we call prose. Like in the fifth canto, there's things that have no meter and stuff like that. I'm not sure about that, but I think it's we say it's prose. But it's not. It's Vedic Sanskrit. And there's a very precise way of chanting it. And it has to be passed down precisely. There can't be a single mistake. And this still goes on in South India, you know, for making these sacrifices work. So there it has. So many reasons like that. You know, they disagree, and you know, they themselves are wondering. But in general, because of Prabhupada's fragrance, you know, more and more, I heard one big scholar saying, you know, that the actually, we have to appreciate the hoary age of the Bhagavad Purana. And so it's just happening. Prabhupada is changing the world. And his disciples, you know, taking his energy, Prabhupada taking Bhaktisiddhanta's energy. And this whole world of Gyan and this kind of thing is becoming more and more appreciating and just changing like that. You know? So Prabhupada says, amongst mundane scholars, there is some diversity of opinion as to the date of the compilation of Srimad Bhagavatam. It is, however, certain from the text of the Bhagavatam that it was compiled after the disappearance of King Parikshit and after the departure of Lord Krishna. When King Parikshit was ruling the world as the king of Bharatvarsha, he chastised the personality of Kali. According to revealed scriptures and astrological calculation, the age of Kali is in its 5,000th year. Now, according to astronomy, too, and recent developments, this is pretty established fact, if you know Sataputta's explanation, because it's describing different constellations and their locations when the Mahabharata war started. So before, people couldn't calculate this. It just requires too much calculation, too sophisticated. It would take thousands of monkeys working, thousands of typewriters, thousands of years, to figure out, you know, the actual. Got a train going by. 1 second here. Okay, you know, audible. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm in Houston. Yeah. So, but then they got these Craig supercomputers. So the technology in the service of the Bhagavatam. And these things could work fast enough to actually do the calculations to go back. And apparently they came up with exactly this, that at 5,000 years ago, the planets and the constellations and everything else were in the exact positions described in the Mahabharata and the Bhagavatam, like that, everything. So Prabhupada says here that according to revealed scriptures and astronomical calculation, the age of Kali is in its 5,000th year. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled not less than 5,000 years ago. Okay. Now compiled, because we're not, Hridayananda Maharaj makes this point, is that, you know, we have certain copies of it. So, and again, it's not like something which is being passed down like exact, you know, byte per byte. It's being passed down like the Bhaktivedanta purports to give us a certain understanding. But Vishwanath Chakravarti has his commentary. Jiva Goswami has his commentary. We do not have those in the Bhaktivedanta purports complete. Now, Prabhupada decided what to include, what was important for his audience. In the original Bhagavatam, it doesn't say Indra, the king of heaven, because everybody in India knows that Indra is the king of heaven. You know, it's kind of like saying Jesus Christ, the son of Mother Mary, every time you say Jesus Christ. We know he's the son of Mother Mary. You know? So the Bhagavatam we have, you know, is the Bhagavatam compiled this time, these people, for this circumstance, for a certain purpose. So if we go back, then the point is that exactly which verses were included, which verses weren't included, you know, 5,000 years ago. And this is, okay, we can accept this. But the main thing is passed on parampara, and it communicates the message. You can see Krishna face to face if you take the Bhagavatam properly like this, what we have. So the kind of thing that Srimad Bhagavatam can be 4 verses, or it can be 18,000 verses, but the thing is, it's that which allows us to experience Krishna directly when we see through the person Bhagavatam. Yeah. Therefore, Bhagavatam was compiled not less than 5,000 years ago. Mahabharata was compiled before Srimad Bhagavatam, and the Puranas were compiled before Mahabharata. That is an estimation of the date of the compilation of the different Vedic literatures. The synopsis of Bhagavatam was given before the detailed description under instruction of Narada. The synopsis of Bhagavatam was given before the description, before the detailed description under the instruction of Narada. So what the synopsis is, again, that may be the 4 verses, you know, or it may be Brahma's explanation to Narada, which is also a synopsis, you know, before Vyasadeva compiled what we have. The Srimad Bhagavatam is the science for following the path of Nivritti Marg. So you notice in the Sanskrit it said Nivritti. The path of Pravritti Marg was condemned by Narada. That path, Pravritti Marg, is the natural inclination for all conditioned souls. The theme of Srimad Bhagavatam is the cure for the materialistic disease of human being, or stopping completely the pangs of material existence. And of course we've got the pangs of the body, the pangs of the mind, you know, the pangs of the heart, pang, 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 like that, ping pong. We're getting beaten around like that, on and on. Just put your name on a ping pong ball and toss it into the game. You know, myself, I'm sure everybody, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, we can get free from all these things and go to a happy place. What's the word? Satyavati? Sukhavati. We can go to the pure land and be with Amitabha Buddha. You know, Satyavati, where there's no broken glass. Everybody's nice and generous and humble. There's no death. And there's all these things we see in this world are there, but in their original form. Everything that exists in this world, houses, gardens, fences, neighbors, is simply a reflection of something that's real. Something really is like this, but it's been reflected on creation, maintenance, and destruction, like that. So it's kind of our you know, contribution here. It's good. 10 minutes left. So anybody comments or any questions or complaints like that?
Yeah, Maharaj, I have a big complaint. We haven't heard from you in so long. Your presentation was absolutely brilliant. Thank you.
Some people
so
may
much.
Disagree.
So I've unmuted everybody, I think. Let's see. Yes, everybody's unmuted right now. So I have a couple of questions, but I'm going to wait for the other Prabhus. If you'd like to make a comment, ask any questions, please go ahead.
Beautiful.
Sundar. Sundar hai. Acha hai. Yeah. Well, it took me long enough to get to do all this work, so I can get one good class after 5 months worth of work, maybe. Yeah. But everybody has a different perspective. You know, I mean, I got my perspective, and we're working in this area. Actually, when we were traveling, for 4 months we went off, we taught in Radha Desh, you know, which we're teaching there at the college on Rupa Goswami's, you know, we teach the southern section, Bhava Bhakti. Then we went to India, and there in Calcutta we have a good friend, Dr. Bandopadhyay, and with him we're doing this, getting involved in this work with like scholars and stuff in India. And it's deadly. I mean, last time I came back last year, not this year, I came back, my mouth was bleeding, and it took me 3 months to recover. It was almost deadly, you know, the pressure we went through. This time I came back, it took 2 weeks to recover. We're making progress. But then also because of our Dhamma Maharaj, our sannyas guru, we went up to the northeast, Manipur, and then they took us all over the place. These places are so primitive. You know, we got off on the airplane and said, okay, now we're going to go to the temple. I thought, okay, we got off in the airplane in Silchar, we're going to go to the temple. It's like, you know, 15 minutes to the temple. So, oh, no, 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 Maharaj, it's about 3 hours. So we got in this jeep and a van packed full of 20 devotees behind us. We started going through the jungles. It was so beautiful. But it was bouncing, you know, dirt roads, broken everything else. And every now and again, you stop at a checkpoint with guys with machine guns and looking and say, oh, okay, you're devotees, go ahead. But be careful. Okay, so we're driving. And it was bouncing so hard that I had to hold on for 3 hours to the, you know, the thing on the car, which you hold on to keep from bouncing. And after I started counting, even though I was holding on, I smashed my head against the thing like 23 times. I bounced my head off the thing like that. So finally we arrive in a place called Ananda Bazaar at like 10 o'clock at night with no paved streets. I guess Haridas Thakur had been there. And all these people have come out for kirtan, dogs, cats, people. And the temple had had grass walls, and we stayed there, initiated 50 people who I'd never met before. Like that. So I had to meet them very quickly. Are you following the four principles in chanting 16 rounds? Yes, for 23 years. Okay, you can be initiated tomorrow. Then we got back in the car to Australia for the first time because we've been pressured to go there. And 6-7 temples there. So different. The atmosphere is so different, different countries. Prabhupada said Australia will be conquered by prasadam, you know. But we also met some very incredible scholars there because of the contacts in India at Monash University. And you know, did our presentations, and they were very satisfied. They wanted us to come back 2 months later. So then back to India, and then we spent a whole week working on our publications there. 3 weeks in Spain, and finally, this is important. We participated in the symposium on education. It's the second one in Radadesh, and then it's really for Europe, but devotees were there from around the world. And they couldn't accommodate more than 32 devotees. It was all on education. And they were representing several thousand students and everything else like that, you know. And so many things came out, everybody getting together and a chance to talk about it. The successful educational programs, almost invariably, you know, schools, universities, gurukulas, it's where the educational institution is legally separate, takes care of its own money and management, but is hand in glove with a local temple. So it's a real, like, you know, personal connection, but management separate. You know? And beyond that, there's just so many things happening. There appears to be something like about 25,000 school-age kids in ISKCON now, you know, primary and secondary age, about 25,000, you know, kids who, if we had our primary schools and secondary schools, they would all be in our schools. What to speak of, you know, of other people who would put their kids in our schools. One, really, of course, the Krishna Bhanti schools has been going on in England. You've all heard about that, with government support, everything. But now, and you can look on the internet for Goloka Education. Goloka Education. And that's Pranadas and Ram Giridhari, who's like, you know, very, very old Gurukula teacher, almost a Prabhupada disciple, just Pranadas almost, you know. And study education, also a headmaster. He combined with Ram Giridhari, who's like 35 years old, a business guy, a nice ISKCON family. But they started Goloka Education, which basically they're building something and they're doing it, which is going to produce something which is going to be like the Montessori schools or the Waldorf schools. And definitely it'll be supply, you know, all the needs for ISKCON devotees, and also be attractive like for people like who put their children in Montessori schools or Waldorf schools. It'll also be accessible for them too. So we're trying to just develop that now in North America and everything else, and that's about, you know, a report on what's happening on this educational development with, you know, Shastric studies and everything like that, you know.
Ecstatic, Maharaj. Two questions just came in. I also have two questions, so maybe we can try and go through these. First question is about the path of Nivritti Marga compared to Pravritti Marga. Can you elaborate on the meanings of these two paths?
Well, I guess, you know, Nivritti Ni means, you know, Prabhupada says one time Vritti means profession, you know, like that. So, for example, like there's in Vastuveda, there's the Maya Dhanava Prakash, and who's the other guy? Vishvakarma Samhita or something like that, you know? So the Vishvakarma produces like ashrams, temples, residential places in the country, near nature, simplifying your necessities, and it's all Vastu in terms of how to get detached from this world. You know, and use this world as a means of austerity to become purified. And Maya Dhanava, he's the architect of the demons, so he produces like Sahara Tahoe and Las Vegas, you know, places that will stimulate your desire for gratification, like that. But in the Vedas, the Pravritti Marg is also progressive. This, I think, you know, the Pravritti Marg, it's progressive, but it's so indirect, you know, that practically speaking, Narada told Vyasa that it's just going to be, Buddha's going to have to come and just wash the whole thing away. You know, what you've done is so indirect that most people will never get it, and it will simply confuse them. You know, it will take them away from the Bhagavatam, all these things. So, Pravritti Marg is the path of material enjoyment, which ultimately culminates in Nivritti Marg, but it's so indirect that it's just practically speaking impossible in the present age. But that's what I understand.
Wonderful. Can we go to the next question? Yeah. Okay, and then I'm trying to summarize this as best as I can. I think what they're asking is there a difference between Lord Buddha and Buddhism as we see nowadays? Is Buddhism completely illusory, useless, like that? That's the gist of the question.
Yeah, of course, you know, Hridayananda Maharaj, you hear a lot from him. He's a great scholar from Oxford, everything there. I'm sorry, from Harvard, everybody else. But he says that, you know, all Buddhists will agree that nobody has Buddha's original teachings, that whatever we have is definitely coming from like third, second, fourth generation or something like that. So Buddhism in general, I mean, there's so many branches. I remember when I looked in the Britannica, if you look for Christianity, it'll say like there's 1,300 different divisions, sects, so-and-so and so-and-sos of Christianity. So Buddhism is no less, you know, in terms of different branches and Nishesha Shoshin Buddhists and Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and they call themselves Buddhists, you know, but they have so many branches, and some of them have different heritages. In general, what is it, Hinayana and Mahayana? Mahayana, where is that from? And what's the other one? Mahayana and Theravadan. So the Theravadan Buddhism is, I think, from Sri Lanka and a few places, maybe Cambodia. And then the other one, the Mahayana, is the one which goes to most of China, and I think also then passes to Japan as Chan Buddhism or Zen Buddhism. So there are many branches like that, and emphasizing different things. As far as I know, what we consider Buddhism in terms of the real exciting things about meditation and, you know, sense gratification and Tantric Buddhism or, you know, something like that, you know. But most Buddhists, they take Buddhism as an ethical and moral system, like that. before Buddha was Confucius. The YouTube is a very, very good BBC documentary biography of Confucius. And he read all the previous works in China. And of course, a lot of those are related to the Vedas. They have Yamarajas, they have Nagas, they have, everything. And then he extracted the essence and produced this really nice thing about how to live and how to share, and even something about, immortality is there in Confucius's ideas. And still very prominent in China. Then Buddhism came, and Buddhists were producing something a little bit different, which is basically more emphasis how to get out of this place. So anyway, there's so many different branches of Buddhism, but some of them are very good. And Prabhupada says that Buddha's real focus was ahimsa, to get free from causing pain to others. Other things too. But his main thing was ahimsa. So he says if the Buddhist cult actually preaches this, and the importance of spiritual investigation, then we're totally in favor of the Buddhist cult. So that's our opinion. It's upadharma, it's pre-religion. Don't hurt other people and take your spiritual life sincerely. Find out if there is a soul and there is a God. So if it preaches that, then we're totally in favor of it. Not everybody's ready to become, Vaishnava or a Gaudiya Vaishnava, like that. Beyond that, so many branches, and one of the biggest, of course, is the Amitabha Buddha, who talks about the pure land, Sukhavati, and many people follow him. There are many Buddhas. Actually, Lord Chaitanya is actually a Buddha, if you want to get technical about it. Yeah. So again, that's what I know.
Wonderful, Maharaj. I have some questions, but I'm still holding off to see if anyone else would like to
speak up. Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Balabhaja. How are you doing, sir?
Where are you?
I'm in Boise. I made it back to Boise.
Made it back alive. Okay.
Yeah, just got back about a couple of days ago. Maharaj, in the earlier part of your talk, you were making some off comments about Diti, and you said how she actually had some sort of a legitimate grievance, wanting to have intercourse because all of her sisters and co-wives had something she didn't have, which was children. Now, my understanding of DT is that she's the mother of the demons. And so it just, from listening to you talking about it, it sounded like she is really like a target of fate to be the mother of all the demons when she's a goddess and all the other co-wives are, have more honorably mentioned children. Is that a fair understanding of DT or something, or what?
A target of fate.
Yeah, I mean, she's the mother of all the demons, What goddess would want to be the mother of a demon,
Even she didn't want it so much, I don't know. That's again, if you ask Sukadeva Goswami, then he'll quote from different histories and tell you why it happened and that kind of stuff like that. But definitely, you see that they're all they're not like this evil people, Later on, maybe in the fourth canto, it's describing all the evil sons of Brahma, hate, envy, deceit, cowardice, But Diti and Aditi and everybody else, they're all like us. They're like us. They have their material desires and maybe good devotees, but, okay. So I don't think she was cheated or anything or forced to take this, but probably she got what she deserved or what she needed to make progress like that. She's still here right now. We can ask her. You can ask her if you want to.
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Pregnancy, a ditty in the evening.
Yeah. If I should see her, I'll ask her.
Okay. Be careful. You may be getting it in over your head.
You're right.
Maharaj, did you say that? I didn't hear you right. That Lord Chaitanya was actually Buddhist. What did you say?
No. I said that there are many Buddhas. There's Amitabha Buddha, Tathagata Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha. So I'm saying that Lord Chaitanya is actually, according to the definition of what is a Buddha, Lord Chaitanya is actually a Buddha. We can even talk about one gardener, a Japanese gardener, said you believe Buddha? He was in Golden Gate Park, like that kind of challenging guy there. And I said, oh, yes, yes, we believe in Golden Buddha. And he said, oh, I never heard that Buddha. And I said, oh, he's Indian Buddha, very nice Buddha. And he said, oh, yes. So we do. There are many Buddhas, and we believe in the Golden Buddha. You know, and the Golden Buddha has his whole nice philosophy.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Mahesh. I just wanted to mention that in Japan, Krishna is Karashima Buddha. And I've seen like bas-relief or murtis of Krishna in some of the Zen Buddhist temples in Japan where he's playing on his flute, and that is Karashima Buddha. Also, one of the most sacred texts and chants from the Zen Buddhists is the Dharani, and in the Dharani, basically is praises and glories to the one who has a blue throat, the one who has the lion face, the one who is the shape of a turtle, and so on. It's one of the most famous and sacred texts of the Zen Buddhism. And so when I read that, I said, well, you know, that sounds like our scriptures. Of course, I spoke with the sensei about it. I said, hey, you know, I mean, do you know who this means? She said, no. I mean, most people in Buddhism, they really don't even know what they are chanting anymore.
No, yeah. It's formalities. So many things like that all over the place. You find, if you're a devotee, you can recognize these things. I mean, very easily, you can establish them. You know, but it's just as soon as all the darkness in the world can't defeat the light of one candle. So as soon as Prabhupada came and started speaking the truth, the simple truth, God, everything's starting to become illuminated, and so many more candles are. I'm more and more appreciative that Prabhupada is not an ordinary person. To call Prabhupada a pure devotee is kind of like minimizing his position, it seems like. He's a lot more than a pure devotee. He seems like, you know, Shakti Avesh Avatar. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. And we're right here at the beginning. Yeah. Ramananda, you got questions? I kind of got to go. 12:37 for me.
Okay, I'll get two quick questions. One is Samhita. If I understood correctly, if I remember, you were saying that the Samhitas. Well, Chris, you were referring to Samhitas as the original Vedas. But anyway, you said that Samhitas mostly like counteract sins and, you know, bad things. I understood that Samhita actually means hymns. Is that correct?
Hymn, or I think Samhita. Okay, probably the word is song, so it's like, you know, sannyas, sankirtan, and hita sounds like benefit, you know. So probably it's compiled words mean something benefit like that. But I think also a samhita is like a compilation, you know, especially that kind of thing, because there's different things, you know, different, I forget what they are, but a samhita is kind of refers to something like, it was like a compilation of the Brahma samhita, like Brahma's putting it all together, a song, for the benefit of everybody, hita, you know.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's a nice one.
And so then the Vedas are, you know, putting it all together so people can get free from disease, so they can get their benefits like that, so on. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And the last question then, if nobody else has one, if you got to go,
I have.
I asked this question a couple of times. I'm sorry. Somebody else has something to say.
It's okay, but just leave a little room for me at the end.
Okay. I've asked this a couple of times. I don't remember if I asked you. If I'm repeating myself, forgive me. But
it happens with old age.
I know. It happened to me when I was born, though. Vedanta Sutra is a sutra is very, very condensed. Okay, so Srimad Bhagavatam is a natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. So we can see in the Sharira Kalpasya, you know, what the interpretation there, or the Govinda Vasya. Of course, I haven't read these things, I just hear about them, that they're explaining the Vedanta Sutra. But the Srimad Bhagavatam, natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, it's not going verse by verse, so this is what this text means. This is what this means, and this, you know, it's there's only at the beginning, Janmadhyasharyata. So can it really be called a commentary? I'm not trying to say this challengingly. I'm trying to.
Yeah. That's a, it's an interesting point, because this maybe, you know, because the Vedanta Sutra, I think, is divided in four chapters. Those were used to divide it into four subsections. Some are longer, some are shorter, like that. So maybe there is some, because for example, all the Puranas, they deal with, what is it, 11 topics or something? You know, creation by Brahma, creation by the Lord, creation by Brahma, creation by the Manus, special protection for the devotees, the ultimate goal of everything. So then Sridhar Swami assigns each of those topics to each of the cantos, one after another. But then Jiva Goswami says, well, no, it's not exactly like that. Yeah. So the names for the cantos come from those different elements. And Prabhupada says, this canto can be called, giving the proper respect to Sridhar Swami, at the same time taking Jiva Goswami's comment that, you know, all the things are discussed. But maybe there's some like, you know, focus like that. So maybe, again, the Vedanta Sutra also, you know, in its progress, that's something I don't know, you know, could you know, there could be a correspondence then between the general progression of the Bhagavatam like that to the Vedanta Sutras, you know. Yeah. So there could be, but I don't know if it's like, he doesn't mention this sutra, and in purport you don't see anything like that either, you know.
Okay, so to summarize, what you're saying is that the Vedanta Sutra has a certain purpose, so the Srimad Bhagavatam is explaining that purpose.
Yeah, that's going on. But also the way it explains it, it may be, like you're saying, that the Vedanta Sutra, the way it explains it in terms of the sequence and how it develops it, may also be the same way the Bhagavatam does it. So there may be a correspondence where somebody who knows both can show that, you know, the Bhagavatam is now commenting on this part.
Mm. Okay, very good. Mm. Dr. Prabhu, I guess you'll be the last.
Okay, Dandavat Maharaj.
Oh, on the contrary.
Glad to see you're back.
Still alive.
So, this is a very interesting verse. Oh. And the great sage Vedavyas, after compiling Srimad Bhagavatam and revising it, taught it to his own son, Sugadeva Goswami, who is already engaged in self-realization. So this is the closest that Srila Prabhupada says that Sugadeva Goswami came back to Bhadaraka Ashram after he left. He just walked away when he came out of the womb. This is the closest that I've seen in Srila Prabhupada's books, and I've heard the details other places, but it's pretty clear he came back to hear the Bhagavatam later. And so I heard many years ago in a Srimad Bhagavatam class, some devotee must have given this, that Sugadeva Goswami heard Srimad Bhagavatam from Vedavyasa in the womb, but I just tried to find that in the Veda base, and I failed to find that. It's mentioned in a number of places that Sugadeva was liberated within the womb, but heard Srimad Bhagavatam later, and on account of that became a great devotee. So, you're traveling and preaching and giving classes and talking to so many devotees. Is this a clear conception in the movement that that Sukadev came back to hear the entire Bhagavatam from Vedavyas on the banks of the Saraswati in Bhadaraka Ashram?
No, as far as I know, I'm going to be becoming enlightened by you. For example, maybe you've also read it, like the Puranic Encyclopedia. I think it's two of them, actually, you know. And as far as I know, Prabhupada used it, you know, for like that. So the Puranic Encyclopedia, somebody went through and would take like a topic like Sukadeva Goswami, and he goes through and takes all the different citations from the Puranas that talk about his birth and all that kind of stuff. So from that source, as I understand, yeah, he's describing that he expanded himself, right? So one expansion could stay with his father and one expansion could do something else. So that's what I've heard, that there are different things, different pastimes, different activities. Sometimes I think from Prabhupada in his purports that Sukadeva Goswami was afraid of taking birth, so he didn't come out. And so, of course, Krishna came and assured him that she won't be attached because you've heard the Bhagavatam. So it could be that the Bhagavatam he heard before he was born wasn't, because actually it says it was, you know, recompiled everything else. So he might have gotten, again, like this little summary, a summary form, which was enough to convince him he wouldn't be attached. And he went out, and then maybe again he heard more details later, you know, like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he delivered the Bhagavatam essentially in the form that we hear it today. And, you know, like Suta Goswami must have been like a Shruti Dar, could remember everything.
Oh.
So he, you know, and by some divine arrangement, he was in the area where Maharaj Parikshit had taken shelter of the sages on the banks of the Ganges, asking what is the duty of a man about to die, and then he delivers the Bhagavatam that he just studied and realized under Veda Vyas.
So that means that, okay, Krishna spoke the Bhagavatam. Krishna came from Dwarka while he was still in the womb. And Maharaj Parikshit, my goodness, you know. So they disappeared. So Maharaj Parikshit became king at Krishna's disappearance. You can't become king unless you're at least 25 years old. So,
right.
So, yeah. And so Maharaj Parikshit left his body something like, what, about 30, about less than 40 years old, you know. So anyway, it's sort of match up here. That's what, 15 years old, 16 years old, like that, and so on. So you go through all these days.
Right.
But part of the problem is, too, is that 5,000 years ago, I think time was a little more flexible than it is now, you know. Even, of course, all these Einstein guys say if you fly off in your spaceship at the speed of light, you come back, you'll discover, you know, that things went slower and everything else. So linear time, as we know it, is a real like imposition, that we've adopted in our civilization in the West. Other cultures don't have this. So the Bhagavatam, I think a lot of the time things are just based upon what may be a valid conception of time and different things like that. So trying to put all these dates on linear stuff like that sometimes may not be exactly the way things happen in reality. You know? So,
right.
But in general, yeah, it's, you know, that's all I know. Okay, I got my call coming in here. So thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. See you all in Goloka.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Prabhu.
All glory to
Srila
Prabhupada.
Hare Bol.
Hare Bol.
Hare Bol.